Well, Derek, thanks so much for joining in this conversation series, The Future is Calling Us to Greatness.
Well, thank you for having me.
One of the things I've been doing at the start is just inviting all of my guests in this series, and so far I've had 48 abso-friggin-lutely amazing conversations, and so I've been looking forward to this one for quite some time. And I've been inviting my guests to help us really get you. Now, most people, I suspect, will probably be familiar with your work to some degree, but help us, like, take 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes, whatever, but take some time, please, and help us sort of get what you're most committed to, how you got to where you are, a little bit of your story, whatever you're led to share, but help us get Derek Jensen.
Well, the most important thing, I mean, I recently had, maybe a year ago, had a primer come out of my work. I've got 20-some books out, and so my publishers decided it was time to put out sort of a greatest hits. And on one level, in terms of, like, career satisfaction, you know, that's something I never could have dreamed of when I was first starting writing, that I'd actually have a greatest hits book. So that was very satisfying, but of course it's, you know, when they put out your greatest hits, it's time to do to reflect on your career.
Yeah.
And I have to say that in the way that really matters, my career is a complete failure. And what I mean by that is that, the only measure, the reason I write is for the salmon and for the meadowlarks and for the frogs, and they're getting hammered and the world is getting absolutely killed. And the only measure by which any of us will be judged by the people who come after is going to be the health of the land base.
Yes.
And on that level, we will all be judged complete failures because, you know, I was doing a radio interview a while back, and at one point the interviewer said, well, gosh, you know, isn't it enough to just fight the good fight? And it's like, no, I'm actually not doing this to stave off feelings of internal insecurity or something. You know, this is not a therapeutic effort on my part.
Right.
There are tangible goals that I want to achieve, such as I want for there to be more wild salmon every year than the year before, and I want for the oceans not to be murdered, and I want for there to be less dioxin in every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. And so, what am I about? I'm all about trying to stop this culture from killing the planet. And if we want to go back to my own history, I guess, you know, I've talked a lot about how my father was extremely abusive, and my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head, and he broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me, beat everybody in the family but me. And so on that level, I was introduced to the insanity and the violation imperative of this culture very early. And even as a kid, I was asking, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it?
Mm.
And so there's one level at which that was part of my introduction to all these issues. Another part of the introduction was that in second grade, they put in a subdivision right near where I lived and right next to where I lived. And all these beautiful meadows got converted to white box houses. And once again, I remember thinking, even as a kid, this can't go on forever.
Yes.
Because if you keep building houses, then eventually the animals, the meadowlarks, the garter snakes, the cottonwood trees will have no place to live. And so my point on that is that, you know, I didn't have sophisticated language, but even as a 7-year-old, I understood you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And it's not, I mean, I made a choice as a child not to have children because there's too many humans. And, you know, overpopulation as such has not been one of my primary issues. I prefer actually to talk about overconsumption and also,
sure,
the violation imperative, the belief that there are no limits, which underlies overconsumption, overpopulation. So those, I'm more interested in talking about those. But on a personal level, once again, I felt so strongly about this, even as a kid. It's like, there's too many of us. I remember This is maybe more
no, this is great. Keep going.
Personal detail than people want, but you know, my parents, my father's very abusive, and my parents got divorced. It was a very, very messy divorce, as often is with abusers. And I went to I kept saying I'm afraid to go see him, and I was sent a number of psychiatrists to see if I actually was afraid, if I was faking it. And my point is that I remember the whole point of me telling you that story is that one of the psychiatrists, one of her questions was, so if you could be a non-human animal, what would it be? And the first answer was, I would be an endangered species, so there'd be one more of them. Wow. And so even when I was, that was when I was probably 10 or 11. So the concern about non-human nature has been here my whole life. And then
actually, if I can just interrupt just
quickly.
Yeah,
please, please.
My great mentor, I've had several major mentors, one of them Joanna Macy, the other Dolores LaChapelle. But my major mentor was Thomas Berry, and he, of course, as those of us who knew and loved him, he was regularly reminding audiences that it was a formative experience that he had very young in life about a meadow, and seeing that anything that benefited any economics, any politics, any way of doing things as human that didn't benefit that meadow was not a good thing. And so it's interesting hearing your story reminded me of that. I actually hadn't thought of that in quite some time.
Well, and I think that that cuts down to you know, I don't remember Otto Leopold's exact line about, but it's basically something is good to the degree to which it, benefits biodiversity, essentially.
Exactly.
And, you know, I think, you know, I did a talk once 10, 12 years ago in, Ohio. And after the talk, this one guy came up to me who knew me because we're both baseball fans. He knew nothing about my work, and he just showed up because, you know, we happened to have contact over baseball, and he came up to me afterwards and he said, you know what you are? You're an ethicist. And I think he's right in a sense. And really the entire morality that I'm trying to build up through my entire series of books can all be summed up, I think, in, something is good if it increases the health of the land base. It's like I was just reading this account by a fairly famous, very famous anti-imperialist who shouldn't speak about environmental issues, because one of the things he said is that one of the ways you measure biological success is through sheer numbers. And I was thinking, wow, that's just the biblical go forth and multiply projected onto the natural world. Or actually, mm-hmm. It's the capitalist model of your success is measured by how many dollars or how many franchises you own. Mm. And it's also just ridiculous because, of course, there's going to be more worms than there are elephants, but that doesn't mean worms are more successful. But then the real point is I started thinking, okay, what would be a measure of biological success that I could get behind? And I think a measure of biological success is a creature is biologically successful if in their numbers and, I mean, if their existence in the numbers in which they exist improves the capacity of the land base to support life and the resilience of the land base,
amen,
thereby ensuring their own future survival as well as the survival, of course, of the land base. And it's extraordinary to me. You know, this is another thing. When I first became an honest-to-goodness activist, I kept being hit by this line that those in power would throw out, which is, we need to balance the needs of the economic system versus the needs of the natural world.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking that I wish that environmentalists would exploit that statement, because what they're saying is that's an explicit acknowledgement that the economic system is harmful to the natural world.
Yes.
And you can't have an economic system that is harmful to the natural world that will last. You have to, if you have an economic system, if you have a social system, if you have a biological community, if you have anything, the way to survive is by improving the health of the land.
Amen.
By your existence. So that's what salmon do. That's what grizzly bears do. That's what bison do. That's what everybody does in their natural relationships is that, I mean, think about it this way. If you have a number 100, you have 100% of health, and the number goes to 99, and then 98, and then 97, eventually it gets to zero. And so what that says to me is you can't have an economic system that harms the land base at all. And
or at least not beyond the inherent repairability, the healing ability of the land base itself.
Well, I'm this could be an interesting discussion we could have, except I think it would take up the whole time just for this, that I think when salmon come up, like if a bear eats a salmon, that's not harming the land base. That's actually moving nutrients.
Yeah.
So I know what you're saying in terms, I think about this a lot. It's like, well, I just walked through the forest and I accidentally stepped on a snail. Had I not walked through the forest, that snail would still be alive. Did I harm the land base? And
yeah, or cutting trees to build a house or whatever. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on this because I think I'm actually pretty much where you are. I mean, I've seen you for quite some time now as one of the major voices in helping us move beyond anthropocentric ethics to biocentric or life-centered or ecocentric ethics. And you know, you quoted Aldo Leopold before. I think the quote is something like, a thing is right if it tends to preserve the diversity, the stability, and the beauty of the life community. A thing is wrong if it tends to do otherwise.
Yep,
One of the quotes that I use at the beginning of almost every sermon I've been preaching recently, I don't know if you know, Connie and I have been traveling for 12 years all over North America, but this year we've been going along the route of the Great March for Climate Action. So we've gone from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. We're now in Pittsburgh on our way to D.C. We've done about 80 of 100 speaking engagements. And the last 4 or 5 sermons, I've begun my scripture reading is from Thomas Berry, where he says basically our predicament and our way into the future can be summed up in 3 sentences. The glory of the human has become the desolation of the earth. The desolation of the earth is becoming the great shame of the human. Therefore, all programs, policies, activities, and institutions must henceforth be judged primarily by the extent to which they inhibit, ignore, or foster a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship.
And that's beautiful.
I think it just says it. That's the essence, as I understand it, of a biocentric earth-honoring, life-honoring perspective. And the fact that we have had a political system, an economic system, a religious system, a scientific way of thinking that has fostered this not only profoundly unsustainable, but to use religious language, demonic. That is, if anything can be called evil, it's pursuing our own wealth, our own pleasure, our own benefit, knowing that it's destroying. It's like the opposite of usufruct. It's destroying the potential for the soil and the forests and the life community to nourish future generations. I mean, if anything deserves the name evil, that's got to be it.
Oh, I completely agree.
So, Aaron, I interrupted you. Continue, please, because I love your work and I love where you're going. So keep going.
Well, thanks. I don't remember what I was saying.
Well, you were sharing a little bit about sort of how you came to this and some of the personal issues that helped you see the violent sort of way that we've been with the land and with future generations. I mean, the whole title of this conversation series is The Future is Calling Us to Greatness. And what I'm sort of trying to hold in a mythic way is that when we live our lives as if the past and past generations, many of whom, most of whom probably, suffered or struggled or in some way sacrificed, and had they not, we wouldn't be alive. So when we hold that in our hearts, then we can forego certain pleasures or comforts or wealth or whatever in order to be a blessing to the larger community of life and to the future. So the sense that the past is rooting for us and the future is calling us to greatness is sort of a mythic mindset that I find to be really useful. So anything that you want to say related to this notion that the future is calling us to greatness and what you see, if anything, that's in the right direction, and what do you see are the most important things that need to be done to be a blessing to the future, or is that even possible?
Well, I think something that I have been, I don't have a lot of optimism, and, you know, I am by temperament a fairly happy person, and I'm happy in my own life, and I'm not depressive, but I've been having a really hard time getting up and doing the work the last bit because I can't bear how – I can't bear what's happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, I live on 40 acres of second growth redwood here in Northern California, and it is wonderful and amazing and beautiful to see the land recover here since my mom and I moved here. And the forest, you can tell, is so happy that we are here. And I can tell you stories about that if you want. But one way why I know that the forest is really happy is there are ways that it has recovered that have been much faster than they were in the previous years. And it's very clear. It feels like there are places where the forest is reproducing when it wasn't before. And I feel like part of the pledge that my mom and I both made is that no trees would ever be cut. And so they're like, okay, well, we can have babies then if we know they're not going to be murdered. And so on one hand, there's that. But on the other hand, just in the 15 years I've been here, the frog populations have collapsed and newt populations and salamander populations and daddy long legs populations. I used to see big clusters of them all winter. Mm. They cluster in places about the size of a dinner plate and then maybe sticking out about, 3 or 4 inches. That's a big cluster of daddy long legs. And then that's how they hang out through the winter. And, I haven't seen any of those clusters for probably 3 or 4 years now. Mm. And I still occasionally see a single, daddy long leg somewhere in the forest. Just so many beings that bats, I used to see bats fairly often, mm-hmm. and I don't see bats anymore. Dragonflies, I used to see maybe 100 at a time over the pond right out there, but I don't see them anymore. I see 2 or 3 at a time. And that, I mean, as you know, there was that report that recently came out about, how wildlife around the world has collapsed by 52% in the last 40 years. And of course, we also have to recognize that in the previous 40 years it probably collapsed another 52%, and previous to that and previous to that. I mean, this is collapse upon collapse upon collapse. I just saw an article in the paper a couple days ago about how the, Thule elk has recovered to 4,000 creatures, and now the dairy farmers further down the coast of California are complaining because the elk are eating too much of their forage. And I'm sorry, prior to the arrival of Europeans, there was at least 500,000 Thule elk mm-hmm. in California. So they're at less than 1% of their population, and they're still complaining. So my point is that it's really hard. And the thing that keeps me going, well, there's a few things that keep me going. One of them is that, and this is true for all of my friends too, is if there is even a 1/10,000th of 1% chance that anything we do makes a difference, then we have to do it.
Yes.
Exactly. And, it's like my friend John Osborne says. He's a wonderful human being and a wonderful activist. And he often says the reason he's doing this work is because we can't predict the future, and he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. Mm-hmm. And what he means by that is if grizzly bears are still around in 10 years, they may be around in 100. If they're gone in 10 years, they're gone forever.
Exactly.
And so basically, and this is what I have, is to take an attitude of not on my watch. You know, these creatures are not going down. And, you know, I'm known for – sometimes people call me the violence guy, which is really unfair because I do talk about fighting back, but – sometimes I feel like I should have written a 1,000-page book called Endgame for Pacifists, which would be 1,000 blank pages with one page in the middle that says sometimes it's okay to fight back, because that's the only thing they hear out of 20-some books of analysis. And I say all the time we need to use every means necessary, and that includes, by the way, one of the things I do is every winter there's a pond right out here, and every winter the frog populations are collapsing because of a mold called Saprolegnia. And it's not Saprolegnia's fault, because Saprolegnia is ubiquitous. And Saprolegnia's job is to take out the weak egg sacs. The problem is with the weakening ozone layer, that's causing some amphibians to have weaker egg sacs. So the Saprolegnia is just doing what the Saprolegnia does, But unfortunately, too many of the egg sacs are weak. And so it, just in the time I've been here, it's gone from, 2% mortality to, 90% mortality on the eggs. So one of the things I do, because what happens is the egg sacs, because of the weakened ozone layer, UVB comes through and weakens the egg sacs. What I do is I get in the pond every weekend all through the winter and I bring in egg sacs and I raise them in the house. And as soon as they hatch, I put them back in. And here's the thing. I hate cold water. I hate cold water more than anything. I have one of my first memories of my entire life is crying in the YMCA locker room because I don't want to get in the cold pool. So when I talk about doing anything, you know, any means necessary, that includes getting naked and getting in a cold pond.
Yeah.
Because the big distinction is not between those who believe in militant resistance and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing.
Yes, yes.
And so that's one of the things. If we had – people all say, you know, gosh, I have no time. And I will admit that a single parent with three children probably has no time. I'll grant that. Mm-hmm. But if you're not a single parent with three children – and if you watch Dancing with the Stars, you got time, you know? It's like if you watch a football game, you got time.
Yeah.
And I like sports. You know, I'm going to go watch a baseball game at my mom's house tonight.
Mm.
But that doesn't alter the fact that I got time. We all got time to do something.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things is I really, you know, I do this series of radio interviews called Resistance Radio. And one of the things I do at the end of every conversation is, what can people do to help? Because basically one of the things I want to do is get people off their butts.
Yes.
You know, do something.
Yep.
I mean, it's, you know, when I started, do you know the story about me and the gasoline?
No.
Oh, this is a great story. Smartest thing I ever did.
Okay.
I'm in my mid-20s and I know this culture is killing the planet. I know the problems are overwhelming. I know I'm just one person. I can't do anything. So I don't do anything. And then I realize I'm not paying enough for gasoline. And this is in my mid-20s and mid-80s. And I'm not paying enough to cover the ecological and social costs of gasoline.
Yes.
So what I decide to do is for every dollar I spend on gas, I'm going to give a dollar to a local, not national, a local environmental organization.
That's fabulous.
Well, except I didn't have any money. So what I decided to do is I would decide to pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. So I would get a tank of gas, which at that point would cost me about $10. And then that means I have to do 2 hours of activism this week.
Okay.
And I started off writing letters to the editor or, you know, and I was so scared when I wrote my first letters to the editor that I used a fake name. And, you know, contrast that with now where I'm calling to bring down civilization using my own name, you know, back then. So my point is don't let fear scare you because we're all so scared that the CIA or the NSA or the bad people or somebody's going to get us. It's like, fine, use a fake name. I don't care. Just don't let that be an excuse not to do the work at all.
Yeah.
So I used a fake name at first, a bunch of fake names. And then after that, I started doing like anti-fur demos, anti-circus demos. And I didn't let my ignorance stop me either because I went to an anti-circus demo and I'm just holding a sign that says circuses are bad. And somebody comes up and says, why are circuses bad? And I say, I don't know. Ask this guy over here. And my point in telling that story is that we all have a million excuses not to act.
Yeah,
and neither poverty, nor fear, nor ignorance were good enough excuses not to act. And hell, you know, I walked in a gay pride march, and I'm not gay, but it doesn't matter because I thought that was a really I thought it would be good to support them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, and then I started having so much fun with the activism, I stopped keeping track of time. But my point is, it got me off my butt.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Derek, one of the things I want to, that's sort of been a subtext to so much of what you've already been sharing, and it ties into another quote that I'll often use in my evening programs, from Thomas Berry. He says, we're talking only to ourselves. We're not talking to the rivers. We're not listening to the wind and the climate. He says, most of the disasters happening now are a consequence of that spiritual autism. And your work and your writings have constantly been inviting people to listen, not as metaphor, but to really listen, like listen from the heart and then interpret. What is the landform saying? What is the ocean? What is your creek? What are the dying frogs saying? What are the missing daddy long legs saying? How is the world through all of its myriad life forms, speaking to us about what we need to do and what we need to change. So anything that you'd like to say about how to listen to the voices of nature, and how that can impact us as human beings?
Well, so many indigenous people have said to me that the primary difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is even the most open-minded Westerners perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really is.
Right.
And people sometimes say, how do you know that you're not projecting? And it's like, you don't. I mean, we don't know.
Yeah, it's a co-creative process.
Yeah, and, you know, frankly, I can't know your experience. I can't know anybody else's experience. I was thinking about this when I wrote my book, Dreams. I'm trying to figure out, you know, what is projection, what is not. And for crying out loud, I will never know what it is like to pee from a woman's perspective. You know, and I will never know what it's like to have sex from a woman's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So what? You know, it's like that, but that doesn't mean that I can't tell whether a woman wants to be sexual with me. You know, it's like, and so one of the things I'll do if people ask me, how do you know a non-human's communicating, is I'll say, okay, first off, have you ever had a dog or a cat? And they'll say, yes, probably. I say, okay, how did the dog or cat let you know when the dog food dish is empty, when the food dish is empty? And it's like, okay, the dog will look at the food dish, look at you, look at the food dish, look at you. It's like, eventually you figure out, did it have to, if you have a lover, does the lover have to say, put this there? Does the lover have to say at every moment with using English, this is what I want you to do next?
Right.
No, you read each other's bodies as well as communicating in English. And so I've thought about this in terms of sort of a, okay, you and I are speaking English. So, oh, I got to tell you this story. So one day I'm over at my mom's doing my laundry and I'm folding towels and my mom comes up and says, would you like some help with that? Okay. And we all have histories with our mothers. And many of those histories are similar. And what I heard my mother say was not, would you like help with that? What I heard her say is, you're folding the towels all wrong. So my mom says, would you like help folding the towels? And I say, no! And my mom says, okay. And so my point is that in somebody that I have literally known all my life, we're speaking English, and there's still this level of miscommunication. Okay, so now let's add to this. Let's say, oh, this is a situation that some of probably people, I love you. And the other person's like, what does that mean? Does that mean that now we're together forever? Does that mean that we just had a nice time? Does that mean that you want to see me tomorrow? Does that mean that we're like best friends? You know, I mean, even words like that can mean so many different things. And so then just imagine what happens if you're trying to communicate with somebody who doesn't speak English. You know, you can still go – somehow you could communicate, I need to go to the bathroom somehow. I was having a conversation with this Russian guy one time 20 years ago, and we both had German in junior high school. So we were both conversing in German, and I wanted to ask him if there were any bears where he lived. And so I started pantomiming, you know. And then it's pretty funny. We both realized that the word for bear in German is bear. So we got there eventually. But at first, we're like, and he's like, does this mean like NKVD? And so, you know, it's KGB. What's it mean? I don't know. Anyway, so just imagine if two people are speaking, one person speaks English, the other person speaks Swahili, there's going to be a lot more room for misunderstanding. And now let's move it. So you don't speak human, one of you speaks dog and one of you speaks human. There's even more room for miscommunication. Just yesterday, I was in a shed at my mom's doing some work, and my mom's dogs are running around outside, and one of the dogs came in the shed, and I thought he was tattling on his sister because I thought she had run down into the forest someplace. And so when I came out to check, he was not actually tattling on her, but he was telling me to come out, just like Lassie with, you know, Timmy's in the well. She had gotten stuck in the blackberries.
Oh.
And so he actually came in to say, and he didn't say, he just, basically all he could communicate is, come out, come out, come out.
Right.
And he still communicated.
Yes.
And okay, but now what if you don't even both speak mammal? What if one of you speaks human, which is mammal? and one of you speaks reptile, there's right. going to be even more room, which doesn't mean they're not communicating.
Right.
That's one of the things that kills me about this whole human supremacism thing is the notion, you know, one of the words that the human supremacists like to throw out of this all the time is we should never anthropomorphize. It's like, oh my God, you're saying we shouldn't anthropomorphize, but you are saying that all intelligences have to resemble ours.
Right. Well, one of my, yeah, exactly. And I think that the one of the better arguments I've heard against that came, I think, originally from Elizabeth Satoris, that so oftentimes when we don't anthropomorphize, we do mechanomorphize. That is, we attribute mechanistic attributes.
Horrible. Horrible. I never use the word ecosystems.
Oh, really?
They're not systems. They're natural communities.
Oh, eco-communities. Yeah, interesting. Huh.
And I don't talk about I don't use that mechanistic language. I do it when I have to. It's not like I'm a fascist about it. But I try not to use it, and I try to speak of communities. It's like people talk about ecological niches being destroyed, and so the creatures who they always say that – the creatures who aren't adaptable, who don't have a lot of adaptability, will die when their niche is destroyed. Well, that's really sort of blaming them for not being adaptable. Instead, I say, what happens when you destroy the fully functioning mutual relationships upon which they depend?
Yes.
And if you talk about destroying their relationships, it puts the onus back on us.
Yes.
And we also realize that, you know, if you destroy all of a human's relationships, they're going to die too.
Yes.
I want to get back to the communication thing and talk about how I know that the land here has really and this is just one of the – a great example of communication. So when I moved in here, I felt like – I just got the vibe that the land is welcoming me some – not really welcoming, but it's like I was a good Nazi, you know? It's like, yeah, if you're going to have a Nazi here, he's okay. But he's still – I don't know. The land didn't trust me. And then I caught this guy 3 days in a row cutting burls on the land, which is just cutting parts off parts of the tree. I caught him on the land, kicked him off every day. And right after that, everything changed. That, okay, in the next few days, first I saw the biggest pile of bear poop I've ever seen. The next day I saw the biggest red-legged frog I've ever seen. And the next day I was walking by these bushes and a bird flew out and brushed my chest with its wing.
Wow.
And that's also the time that the land here started exploding.
Mm.
And I feel like, and once again, I could be projecting.
Yeah,
but
sure, whatever.
I feel like that was when the land, it's like I did something tangible to protect the land.
Yes.
I said, okay. I mean, it's just like a human being. Okay. I mean, what would you do? Let's say, you know, evil, you know, enemy of the day from the United States conquers the United States. And you know, you meet one of these people, and at first you're like, I don't trust them. But then they do some stuff tangibly to protect you. It's like, okay, I'll trust them a little bit. And then maybe I'll trust them a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, why would they communicate with us when we have systematically pretended they don't exist?
Mm-hmm.
And how this manifests for me on a day-to-day basis is a lot of my writing, a lot of the ideas I'll have when I'm taking a walk through the forest. And at first I was thinking that it was sort of a peripatetic thing, that it's the act of walking is – but then I notice that there's actually some parts of the forest where I get more ideas than others.
Mm.
And I almost, it feels like, you know, it's so often I can get stuck writing. I just walk out in the forest and ask the question and usually I get an answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm so glad that you're bringing this up because what it reminds me, I've been saying now for the last couple of years that I think the most important empirical discovery about religion in the last 100 years is that our brains inherently give human characteristics to what is other than human, what's more than human. And that actually helps us relate to them. Martin Buber's famous book, I and Thou, talks about the radical difference between an I-it relationship, where we use someone or something or some aspect of nature or we think we are for our benefit, or we relate to it as a thou, to be honored, respected, related to, listened to, and that one is sustainable and one's not. But also James Hillman, the famous psychologist, talked about, you know, that to enter myth, we must personify. And he was always critical of the idea that it's just merely the human brain that is personifying what's not human, that it's a real co-creative process, and that we know of no culture that has survived any length of time that hasn't had an I-thou personal relationship to reality. And all the gods and goddesses are personifications, not persons. And so that's one of the reasons why I was grateful that just in the last week that Julia Roberts and Harrison Ford and some of these others, these Hollywood big guns, have started personifying, like Harrison Ford, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but Harrison Ford speaks as the ocean. He says, you know, and I mean, it's like Poseidon speaking, you know, and although he's not using Poseidon, which would be too easily to dismiss, oh, that's just a mythic thing, but he's the ocean speaking. Julia Roberts speaks as nature. And I mean, it's just, it's kick ass. I encourage you to check these out because they're using that, that, technique of personifying, but it also can grab our hearts and move us beyond sort of the rational stuff to really get that, oh my God, we are not more powerful than nature. We are subject to nature. We are up against hard ecological limits. And by God, if we don't come back into a humble, harmonious relationship with the nature, we're causing our own extinction and condemning countless other species to extinction.
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
Anyway, I got carried away. Sorry about that.
No, it's great. It's great. I don't really know what to say because I agree with all that. And it's I think I want to say another thing about projecting just because I think this is pretty funny. There's, you know, they're always talking about don't anthropomorphize. And do you know about, I'm sure you do, about plant communication and how they can communicate? Like if one plant is being eaten by caterpillars, it can communicate to other plants and tell them to change the palatability and toxicity of their leaves.
Yep.
Okay. So there were some scientists who were getting mad at the plant scientists who were saying this. And the the people who were saying it wasn't communication, a couple of them were going, gosh, we don't actually think this is communication. Instead, we think this is plant soliloquies, where the plant is communicating to itself, just basically talking to itself. And if anybody else hears this and gets anything good out of it, then so much the better. And I started thinking, it was two middle-aged white guys who said this. And it's like, seriously, two middle-aged white guys who are saying that we should not anthropomorphize and are also saying that plants basically just talk to hear themselves talk. And if anybody else gets a benefit out of it, so much the better. It's like, project much?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Anyway.
Well,
there's, I guess one more thing I want to say about the whole human supremacism thing. I'm just finishing a book on it. It just kills me. All the arguments for human supremacism are so tautological. Like, humans have large brains. Therefore, large brains are a sign of intelligence because, of course, we have to be the most intelligent. But the thing that's embarrassing about that is that humans don't even have the largest brains by far. Our brain's about 3 pounds. Walruses are 2.5. Whales can be up to 12 or something. Elephants are much bigger. And so then they say, well, it's not actually brain size that matters. What's important is brain size to body mass ratio. That's what's important. And, okay, that's really embarrassing because humans are about a 2.5% brain mass to body weight ratio. And that's about the same as it is for mice. And songbirds are about 8%. The biggest is shrews at 10%. Mm. So then, of course, what they say is, well, gosh, that's not a measure either. Well, of course it isn't, because it doesn't make us number one. I mean, that's where I think a lot of this comes from, is just this, there's a profound, okay, I guess where I want to go is that one of the things we're up against is the problems are not simply selfishness, it's not simply arrogance. But I think part of the problem is that we have a huge void of, one of the central rules of patriarchy, I'll back up, that part of the problem is that there is a violation imperative that is at the core of this culture, that if it exists, it must be violated. And this is crucial to supremacy and crucial to everything we're seeing around us, is that violation is not an action that one does, but it becomes one's identity itself. And that the reason is because you have to feel superior to others. And what is the best way, the most convenient way to feel superior is by... So what Hunter finds, those who are superficially different, who are immediately identifiable as different, such as women, such as people of other races, people of other species, and then you identify them as different, and the difference, and of course we're all different, you know, males, men and women are different, and trees and salmon are different. But the problem is not in noticing the difference, the problem is in perceiving the distance as the difference as a reason for superiority.
Mm-hmm.
So humans aren't superior to trees. Men aren't superior to women. Women aren't superior to men. Whites aren't superior to Africans or to blacks, to any other race, mm-hmm. any other skin color. Those are all differences that are turned into ways to violate, ways to... Okay, so the point is, you perceive yourself as superior to this other. How do you make sure that you're superior? How do you validate that superiority? You do that by violating them. Because if you couldn't violate them, I mean, if you, obviously they are inferior, because if they weren't inferior, you couldn't violate them. It ends up this circular logic.
Well, yeah,
but
well,
it's self-reinforcing.
One of the challenges though is that to some degree, that in-group, out-group mentality is pretty damn instinctual.
I don't have a problem with that. My point is that the in-group, out-group mentality does not have to lead to violation.
Yes, I agree.
That's totally the problem. Yeah. It's not... I completely agree. And I mean, it's like so many indigenous nations, their name for themselves is the people.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, they didn't commit genocide against everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Anishinaabe called the Dakota their honored enemy.
Yeah.
So they might kill an individual, yeah. and they might take some of their land, but the existence, even of a person they considered an enemy, was still a necessary part of the universe.
Right, exactly.
It would never have occurred to them to exterminate them. That would be unthinkable. And it's the same here. I'm not saying that trees are not different. I'm not saying that
that
beavers can't eat trees, because of course beavers can eat trees, but what they can't do is perceive themselves as superior to trees, and therefore the trees are violable and violating them for the sake of violation. And once you understand the violation imperative, which I've done a terrible job of describing today, but once you understand that, it helps explain a lot of things, such as no limits on scientific knowledge, because we cannot be limited. Everything must be violable. Mm. This is why they bombed the moon. This is why they have to send probes to the deepest folds of the ocean. This is why they have to blow up an asteroid. This is why it's like, if there's a limit, it has to be violated. Because, and there's a great line by R.D. Lang, how do you plug a void plugging a void? The problem is that these violations are not actually solving the problem, the existential emptiness that they purport to fill.
Mm.
And because there is always someone new, your superiority, if your identity is based on being superior to others, your identity is by definition other-oriented, which means you can never be content, because there can always be some other new person out there who could be superior to you. Once you the problem is perceiving this world in this hierarchy in the first place.
Right.
That's just nuts.
Right.
It's not. And once again, I'm sorry, I've done a really terrible job of explicating the violation imperative, but it's part of what we face is that, see, here's, if I could say one thing that I think is central to all my work that I don't see in a lot of other people saying, is that the problems we face are not fundamentally rational, and therefore they're not amenable to rational solution.
Mm.
And I'm not saying people shouldn't devise alternative economies, but this is, it's kind of like, you know, there was all this resistance to Hitler in World War II, and I think sometimes by Karl Gordeller. He was the mayor of, I think, Leipzig, who was part of the resistance, but one of the main things he did, he was tireless, but one of the things he did was he would spend a lot of time planning how the post-Hitler government would be.
Mm.
And that's great to have something in place, but you're kind of skipping a step of actually stopping the madman.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, I did a talk at Bioneers, and it broke my heart for a couple of reasons. One is that I was, well, the reasons are the same, is I was the only person who was talking either about psychopathology or power. And I don't understand how you can talk about the murder planet without talking about psychopathology. I don't understand how you can talk about social change without talking about power in one way or another. And my point on bringing all this up is that the response by the government, or the response by the culture to the melting of the Arctic ice caps has been lust for the increased resources available. It's not been terror.
Mm-hmm.
It's not been shame. And the only way that I can make sense, years ago I talked to Luis Rodriguez, who wrote Gang Days in L.A., La Vida Loca. It's about getting out of a gang through literature revolution. And one of the questions I asked him is, why do all these gang kids stand on street corners killing mirror images of themselves? And he said it's because they want to die. And the reason they want to die is because they're teenagers. And teenagers are supposed to want to die because you have to die to your childhood to become an adult. And nobody's telling them this death can be spiritual and metaphorical.
Mm.
And part of the – there's a bunch of components to the death urge this culture has. But one part of it is that everybody knows that this way of life is not sustainable and it's really miserable. And it provides us with lots of goodies. But existentially, it's a complete mess.
Mm-hmm.
And they understand this, and they want it to end, but they don't understand that the end can be spiritual and metaphorical. It goes around killing everything that's standing. That's the thing, is it's really – you have – it's like, well, the thing I'm writing about right now on the Human Supremacism book is the mirror test of self-awareness. You know that test, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it's completely ridiculous on a whole ton of levels. You know, of course, a bat could say, what, you can't hear your own echolocation? You must not be self-aware. I mean, it's just absurd. But leaving all those aside, my biggest problem with the self-awareness test is this a big joke? You think humans are self-aware? Look in the mirror. When we look in the mirror, we see God's gift to the universe.
Yes.
We don't see anybody who's killing the planet.
Yes.
We don't see these horrible, horrible monsters. One of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to say it's kind of like – it's a weird version – it's like the mirror of Dorian Gray, where we keep looking in the mirror and the mirror keeps showing us looking nice and clean and healthy and happy. And what we're really doing is we are – it's like they call this the Anthropocene lately. They're calling it the age of man.
Mm-hmm.
And that just pisses me off for a number of reasons, one of which is we're narcissistic enough already. It's like Gilgamesh wanted to create a name for himself, and so he cut down a forest. And what? So now you're killing the planet. You name an age after yourself, of course. But the other reason is if we're going to do that, let's call it the sociopathocene. Because Anthropocene is like, yeah, we're number one. That's okay. But let's tell it like it really is, which is you got to be sociopaths to kill the oceans.
Yeah.
I mean, they're killing the oceans. This is not some local. I mean, yes, it's terrible when any species goes extinct, and it's terrible when the frogs are dying in this pond. They're killing the oceans. The oceans. And the response is – so anyway, my point is that I think one of the things that's central to my work is we need to understand that we – you don't just stop Ted Bundy by saying, hey, dude, it's a bad idea. Yes, we need to talk about it. It's wonderful that you're doing all these. It's so important. It's incredibly important. My books, I think, are important. I think that's really important. But that doesn't alter the fact that you can't stop a psychosis through reason.
Yeah.
And so this is a culture that's completely psychotic. Do you know the story about the American Indians and the wolves and the having the conference?
I don't think so.
Soon after the Europeans arrived on this continent, a bunch of the American Indians in the Northeast, I don't know which nations, wanted to all get together to discuss this because they couldn't figure out why the whites are killing all the wolves. It's like, it just doesn't make any sense. So they got together and had this big talk for several days, and all they could come up with is they're crazy. And it's like, well, I don't think I can do better than that, you know? Mm. But my point is I think it's really, really important for us to recognize, once again, I'm not saying we shouldn't do try to point out reasonably thought errors and everything else, but I think we also need to recognize that the problems are much bigger than simply making a, you know, doing tweaks to an infrastructure.
Right. Yeah. No, I 100% agree. In fact, one of the things that reading Deep Green Resistance recently, and then also Naomi Klein's new book, This Changes Everything, which I think is one of the best books I've ever read in my life, certainly one of the most important. Just came out 2 weeks ago. I just finished reading it, listening to it last week, and then I ordered the hardcover because there was about 50, 60 times throughout the book, maybe 100 times, where I thought, oh, my God, I got to quote her, or I got to use that language because I'm a preacher. And so I bought the hardcover so I can reread it and mark it up. But yeah, the talking, the clicking on something online to make your voice heard, to do whatever, all these are just they're nothing. I mean, they give you the illusion that you're doing something when in most cases you're not. And the changes that have to be made in the next 5 to 10 years, it seems to me, that one of the points that you've made many times is that, you know, do you really think, in fact, I'll let you say it. I mean, the way that you put the two things I wanted to ask you about before we conclude this, one is sort of this question that you always ask people, and then the follow-up question around, do you think things are voluntarily going to change? And then the other is a passage that I've seen now in several different forms where you say, you know, whatever it is that ultimately stops this, whether this, that, or the other, and then you have this litany that's so kick-ass where you basically say, they're not going to care about this, they're not going to care about that, they're not going to care about this, they're not going to care about that. To whatever degree you have that internalized or memorized or can generate that, I'd love for you to do that.
Well, the people who come after are not going to care about how hard we tried. They're not going to care if we were nice people. They're not going to care if we signed petitions. They're not going to care if we voted Democrat, Republican, or Green. They're not going to care if we wrote really good books. They're not going to care if we wrote really bad books. They're not going to care if we wrote really big books. They're not going to care if we did a whole series of interviews. They're not going to care if we did a whole bunch of preaching, no matter how wonderful the sermons are. They're not going to care how brilliant Thomas Berry was. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. Yeah. They're going to care about whether the land can give them food that they can eat. That's the bottom line always. Mm-hmm. See, that's the thing is I am a firm opponent of human supremacism, and I'm a firm opponent of anthropocentrism, but long-term anthropocentrism is actually biocentrism too. Because no bio, no anthro, right. You know? And this is one of the things that kills me about all the so-called solutions to global warming. They all take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which, not who, must conform to industrial capitalism. And that's completely nuts, because without a world, you don't have any social system whatsoever. So,
yeah, no, Naomi Klein's saying the same thing. You'll love this book, I guarantee it.
So the bottom line of everything is the health of the land.
Yes.
And I am embarrassed that I even have to say this, because it's just so obvious, you know? Like, without the planet to support you, you don't have life. And so that's the second question. The first question, what was the first question?
Well, the first question is related to when you ask audiences, do you think that that things will voluntarily shift?
That's a question I've asked for years, is do you believe we'll undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living? And I've asked literally 10,000, 20,000 people by now, and nobody ever says, oh, one of my talks, this one guy raised his hand, and then he looked around and he said, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And so, yeah, we will be living in a sane and sustainable way of living at some point, or we won't be living at all.
Exactly.
By definition. And the only question is what's left of the world when we get there. But will it be a voluntary transformation? I don't see it. You know, and one of the reasons I know we won't see it is because of off-road vehicles. You know, it's like, if we have to fight about off-road vehicles, that's not even food, clothing or shelter. That's just go-karts for adults. Mm-hmm. You know, and we still have to fight to keep them out of endangered species areas. It's just nuts. Mm-hmm. And we have to fight all sorts. You know, you can come up with your favorite example of that. Some of the battles we have to fight are so crazy. And So no, I don't think there's going to be a voluntary transformation. The next question becomes, if you don't believe there's going to be a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? Mm-hmm. And the answer is we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we spend so much time pretending that we have all, that we have hope that the system's going to miraculously change. And I'm sorry, but I don't want to leave the fate of the world up to a completely false hope. And I think that what we desperately need to do, and this is what I tried to do with Endgame and tried to do with DGR and tried to do with all my work, is we need to start by having a conversation about what it means for our strategy and for our tactics. And then we have to move from there. It's like, I just read this thing the other day where this, once again, this anti-imperialist was saying there is no evidence that agriculture is inherently destructive. I was like, 6,000 years doesn't count. And then he also said, if agriculture is inherently destructive, we should all kiss ourselves goodbye. And I'm like, no. If agriculture is inherently destructive, we need to have that conversation. We need to start talking about that now because we are headed down a tunnel. We're driving a car down a tunnel at 100 miles an hour, and there's a brick wall right in front of us. And so do we say, oh, there's a brick wall in front of us, I guess we should all kiss ourselves goodbye? No, what you do is you hit the brake.
Exactly.
Because I would rather hit the wall at 90 than 100, and 80 than 90, and 70 than 80, and 60 than 70.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you do is you try to slow it as much as possible or bring it down in place. You know, you try to do whatever you can to save as much life as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
so,
yeah, well, and when you look at just in the last 80 years, the developments that have unfolded around biointensive gardening, permaculture, and a whole host of ways to relate to the soil that aren't rapacious, that aren't destructive, that aren't violent, that are in fact building soil and working with the land and attending to and paying attention to what the land and what the soil and what the trees and what the vegetation is telling us. I think there are ways of feeding not 7 billion people, but I think there are ways of feeding humans on a much smaller scale that are still in alignment with usufruct. That is relating to the land, relating to the soil in ways that allow future generations to thrive. And we're so far from there now that, yeah, anything now seems so radical. But I agree with you. We need to put on the brakes and stop or try or slow down.
Yeah, and we need to. But the first thing we need to do is recognize that, yes, there is indeed a brick wall. Yes, indeed, we are traveling 100 miles an hour. And we need to – it's like a doctor friend of mine always says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to be honest. We need to be ruthlessly honest and eliminate false hopes and then examine our situation and – also, another thing I think we need to do is to start being more clear about what it is we want. And I think we need to be, as environmentalists, this is incredibly important because environmentalism has been hijacked almost completely on the institutional level over the past 30 years and is no longer about trying to save wild places and wild beings and become about sustainability, become about sustaining this destructive culture, which is the worst thing possible. Right. And you know, I've been trying to figure out one of my problems with a lot of the climate change movement is, not all of it by any means, but a lot of it is that, you know, there's an environmentalist friend of mine who says that a lot of environmental activists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, then they question the foundations of Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Because they, once the questions start, they don't stop. But there are so many climate activists who have not gone that direction and who, for years, I've been wondering, what is wrong with them? I don't understand why they're trying to go the direction they are until I suddenly realized that the truth is that a lot of them aren't actually environmental activists.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't come from grassroots activism.
Right.
Before we do the wind down, though, I just want to finish that point,
sure.
Which is I think that we as environmentalists need to be very clear about what we want. I mean, are we hoping, do we want to sustain the society? Do we want to have jobs. I want to have more wild salmon. I don't want to have more migratory songbirds. I want to have more amphibians. I want to stop white nose fungus, or white nose disease. And I want to, I mean, it's very clear.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really important question we need to ask even before we talk about strategy,
mm-hmm.
is we need to ask, what do we want?
Right.
And we need to have honest questions about that. And, you know, I can work with somebody who wants to sustain this society I can work with them so far. Right. I can work them insofar as we have agreements. But then when we have disagreements, I'll have to not work with them. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean I have to attack them either. That's right. Another big problem we can talk about. But it just means I think we should be clear on where we are in alignment, where we're not in alignment. What do we want? I think every activist needs to be asking themselves, what am I fighting for?
Yeah. Yep, I'm with you. There's one question that I've asked all my guests. It's a little off the wall, but it's been getting some interesting results, which is, if you could have any three people in human history, alive today or at any time in the past, to a dinner party where all four of you are together, or in a one-on-one situation over a beer, glass of wine, or, you know, hike or whatever, who would those three people be, and why would you choose them?
Gosh, sorry, I'll have to think on that one. The only answer I have right now is a very bad joke.
Okay.
Which would be Descartes before he came up with his whole philosophy, so I could push him off a cliff.
Okay.
But that's a joke, and it's just going to hurt my reputation even more.
Okay.
It's a joke, I'm telling everybody. It's a joke. I don't want to kill Descartes. Although I'm sure lots of vivisected animals would be urging me on.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know who... You know, I think of, you know, Andrea Dworkin's one of my heroes. John Muir's great. You know, I dedicated the book to Tecumseh.
Mm-hmm, when I interviewed Lara Keith, she wanted you as one of the three.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. Yeah, I'll think on it. Think on it and get back to you. And then what the other question was?
The other question is just anything that you'd like to say in conclusion, and then where would you recommend people go to go more deeply into your work?
Well, they can go to the library and find my books, or they can go to derrickjensen.org, DerrickJensen.org. And so far as what they should do, find what you love and then defend your beloved, and find out what your gifts are and ask yourself, what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? Because the world needs you.
Yeah.
And no matter what your gifts are, some people have gifts for organization, not me. Some people have gifts for writing. Some people have gifts for speaking to people they don't know. Lots of people have lots of different gifts, and we need them all.
Yeah. Aho. Well, thank you, Derrick. This has been wonderful.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Yeah. I look forward to it. The next time that we're out in California, I'll let you know ahead of time and see if we can get together.
Great. I look forward to that.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye.